I just want to make a brief correction from last week. Last week we discussed, we said there's a Gemara that says there were three gifts given to the Jews that only came through hardship. And I told you I remember two of them, I forgot the third. So I got the third one now. So the two we remembered last week was the land of Israel comes only through hardship. That's a gift from God to the Jewish people. The Torah comes through hardship, and that's a gift from God to the Jewish people. And the third one last week I had forgotten. The third one is Olam Haba, the world to come. The world to come as well is a gift to the Jewish people that comes through hardship. I just wanted to make that correction, because last week I'd forgotten that the third gift from God to the Jewish people. So for this week, we are right now in the middle of the period of Spiros HaOmer, and I'm going to go off topic temporarily this week again, but I think it's worthwhile to discuss these concepts. During the period of Spiros HaOmer, the main purpose of Spiros HaOmer, counting of the Omer, is to link Pesach to Shavuos, linking the Exodus to the giving of the Torah of Mount Sinai. That's the main purpose of it. Technically, it should be a very joyous period. It's a period where we're excited, we're preparing for the big day when God finally gives us His precious gift of the Torah. And it should be a period of growth and preparation to receive the Torah. However, we're aware that there is a sad element to this period of history. We have mourning practices which have crept into our observance of counting of the Omer. These mourning practices mainly are attributed to one event, and that event was the death of Rabbi Akiva's 24,000 students. The Gemara tells us, it's in Maseches Yevamos, in the Talmud, the Gemara tells us that Rabbi Akiva had 12,000 pairs of students, the Gemara says, and they all died during this time of year, between Pesach and Shavuos. And it says, why did they die? Because they didn't respect one another. They didn't show respect from one to the other, so God sent a plague which killed them, which is supposed to be a message to us, to teach us about those, when we're approaching Shavuos, and we're ready to accept the Torah. We have to understand that accepting the Torah doesn't just mean the ideas and the actions, it means becoming better people. It means respecting one another, seeing the good in one another, and God, as it were, took them as an example for us to show that how much these were the greatest, Rabbi Akiva's students were the greatest scholars of the Jewish people, and they all died within the period of a few weeks. And that's to teach us a very important lesson of honoring one another. So,
really embarrassing question, but what role does leadership play in that?
Well, leadership play in that? I don't know. Maybe we'll get to that later, but that's not my main topic for today. But I mean, I think what Phil's getting at is, do we look at Rabbi Akiva as somewhat to blame, for the fact that students were honoring one another? There are different approaches to that question, but I wasn't planning on approaching that today. Yeah?
I just have a quick question. Like the 3 weeks is like a bad time of the year, dangerous time, like 9 days, dangerous time of year. So is the Omer considered also a bad time of the year?
Not the same way. I mean, it comes down to, you're not supposed to say the blessing of Shechianu during the 9 days, or the 3 weeks prior to Tisha B'Av. Shechianu means that God has brought me to this day. So we don't thank God for bringing us to the time of destruction of the temple. So you're about to say that bracha during the first verse of Omer. It's not considered an inauspicious time like that.
Well, I was thinking that, like, the bombing and all these explosions are happening, like,
right.
Is it related?
Right. I don't know. I don't know if it's related. But technically, the sources do not paint this period the same way they paint 3 weeks and 9 days before Tisha B'Av. That's considered really an inauspicious time for the Jews, where bad things happen. This period, we did have tragedies. And it wasn't just this. There were tragedies throughout the year, throughout the generations during this time of year. Different pogroms, different uprisings against the Jews throughout history did occur during this time of year. But it's not painted with the same negativity as the time of before Tisha B'Av is. So what I want to get to today is not this story of Rabbi Akiva's students, but I want to talk about Rabbi Akiva a little bit. Rabbi Akiva is one of the greatest sages in Talmudic times. Rabbi Akiva should serve as an inspiration to all of us. He was a towering personality in Jewish history. His influence, his impact, sticks with us this very day. And I want to try to give a kind of a biographical sketch of Rabbi Akiva and teach some of his lessons. And there's a reason. I mean, there's Rabbi Akiva is the one. The Gemara tells us, after his 24,000 students died, he went to the south, it says, and he found five more students. And those five students, which he then took on after the death of basically his entire academy, they were the ones that carry on the traditions of the oral law. They're the ones who became the teachers of the Jewish people. They're the ones who became the basis of the Mishnah and the Talmud, those five students. So Rabbi Akiva really, he was the one who was seen as the one who passed on the oral tradition from Moses. He was a big link in that tradition, which I'm going to talk about. Rabbi Akiva should be an inspiration to us all. So let's talk about Rabbi Akiva a little bit. We'll touch a little bit on what happened to his students, but I think his name is very much part of this time of year, so we should understand him a little bit. So first and foremost, Rabbi Akiva was born into a very poor family, from very humble roots. We have sources that he was a descendant from converts. There are sources to say that he was a descendant of the evil general Sisera. If you look in the book of Shoftim, Judges, Sisera was one of the Canaanite generals who came and fought against the Jewish people. The leader of the Jews at the time was Devorah, who was the judge at the time, one of our female judges, Devorah, and she and Barak led a battle against this evil Sisera. And the Talmud tells us that Sisera had descendants who became Jews and became scholars, and our sources say Rabbi Akiva was one of these descendants. So Rabbi Akiva came from a very poor family. He descended from an evil Canaanite general. And at first he was born, he was uneducated, unlettered, he was an ignorant of Torah. He was a very poor shepherd. And that was Rabbi Akiva's beginnings. And he even tells us, Rabbi Akiva himself is quoted to say in the Talmud, that when he was, in the beginning of his life, when he was ignorant of Torah, he hated Torah scholars. He says, "I would have bit a Torah scholar like a donkey." That's what he says. So his students asked him, "Why do you say like a donkey? Why not like a dog?" He says, "Because when a dog bites, it doesn't break bones. When a donkey bites, it breaks bones." That's what he said. So he had a vicious hatred even for Torah scholars. That's Rabbi Akiva himself said in the Talmud. But yet, we see what became of him towards the end of his life. I guess he was one of the first records of a real Baal Tshuva. You know, he really flipped himself around, you know, and really became a great person from eventually hating Torah scholars. Yes.
He said that he may have come from converts.
Yes.
So he was
born Jewish, but I'm saying he descended from converts. He was born Jewish, so that's clear. Yeah, he was born Jewish. No, but I mean, Sisera, this general, lived probably 1,000 years before Rabbi Akiva, but our sources say that Rabbi Akiva came in a line from Sisera. He worked as a very poor shepherd. So his boss, when he was young, he was working as a poor shepherd, his boss was a gentleman by the name of Ben Kalva Savua. Ben Kalva Savua is a very famous name in the Gemara. He was an extremely wealthy person. And the reason he's called Ben Kalva Savua means a satiated dog. That's what a kelev, this is Aramaic, kelev savua, satiated dog, satisfied dog. So why was he called? This is actually a praise of this man. Why was he called that? Because he was so wealthy, everyone who's poor came to his house. And it says you'd come to his house hungry like a dog, and you'd leave satiated. That's what the Talmud tells us. So he got the nickname, the satiated dog, because anybody who came to his house hungry as a dog would leave full and content.
When was it?
About what year?
Yeah.
Let's say approximately around the year 100 CE. Around that time. I don't know the exact date, but somewhere in, let's say, between first and second centuries.
And what was the name again?
Of his boss? Ben Kalva Savua. Kalva Savua. The son of a satiated dog. So you enter his house, he's so wealthy, you enter his house hungry as a dog, you leave happy. That's it. Peter, that's his nickname. That's what he got. So he's a very wealthy man. He was respected by the people of Jerusalem. The Talmud relates a story during the Roman siege on the city of Jerusalem prior to the destruction of the temple, the Beis Hamikdash. So the city was walled, and it was somewhat protected. And the Jews were trying not to fight. They didn't want to fight. They were trying to maintain the peace and just stay within the city. There was three wealthy gentlemen who had enough money stored up to support the city for, I believe, 21 years, I think it was. And he was one of those gentlemen. So there's three people who had enough money to support the entire city of Jerusalem for 21 years, with the entire city closed off, and he was one of these people. He was a very wealthy man. But what happened? So the story goes, that the Gemara tells us, that he had a daughter. His daughter, we learn her name is Rachel, the famous daughter, the famous wife of Rabbi Akiva. And she saw this poor shepherd of her father. She saw something special about the shepherd. Rabbi Akiva at this time was still an ignoramus, didn't know anything, apparently had a hatred for Torah scholars. But the Gemara says that she saw he was, the words used are tsanua umali. He was modest and had good character. So he may have been ignorant, but he was a good, modest person with a very good character. And she saw potential. She saw this man could be a great man. Why is he working as a shepherd? We can make something out of him. So she makes a deal with him. She didn't care that he was ignorant. She said to him, if I marry you, you'll go off and study Torah. And, you know, this is a daughter of a very wealthy man, probably an attractive young woman, and he says, I'm in. That's what he says. You know? That's what he tells her.
Hard decision.
Right.
How many years can your father support me? So
the problem is going to be that her father was not happy about this. Because her father did not want her marrying this ignoramus, his shepherd, you know. Her father, I know I'm the wealthiest man in Jerusalem. I can choose any of these great scholars to be your husband. They'll all be happy to marry you. Why are you choosing this ignorant shepherd? So she married him privately and sent him off to learn Torah. But we just see an important lesson just in this before we go with the story, which is that the person's knowledge comes second. But under a person's midos, a person's character, a person being a modest and good person, that's the building block for becoming great in Torah knowledge as well. So she said that, you know, I understand right now he's never studied a word of Torah, doesn't even know his aleph bays, he doesn't know anything. But I see he's a good person, I see he's a modest person, I see he's humble, therefore I see that he has potential to become great. And therefore, if he just goes and studies Torah, he's going to become a great person. That's what she saw.
How many years was it
away? We'll get to that in a minute. So that's what she saw, which is an important lesson for all of us, I think. Some people just weren't privileged with the education, but someone who's a good person, you know, as long as if they go study Torah, they can become great spiritually as well, because they worked on their amidos first. We have a concept, derech eretz kamo Torah, the derech eretz, a person's character is kind of a prerequisite to Torah knowledge. So Rabbi Akiva had that prerequisite. He had good character, he was a fine, humble person, and built upon that could be the Torah knowledge to make him even greater. And that's what she saw. But her father was unhappy with this. And she had to marry him privately.
When you said privately, what does that actually mean?
In other words, she didn't let her father in that they got married.
Without the father's knowledge?
Father did not know. Her father did not know this. Yes.
Were there two witnesses at the wedding?
There had to be, yeah. There had to be. Halachically, there has to be two witnesses on the wedding so to have it actually be a real marriage, halachically. But her father did not know in the beginning. She married him privately, sent him off to study. There is a source in the Gemara that before he went off to study, they actually lived, kind of before or after, but it seems to be they lived in a hay silo, temporarily. Wow. I'll get to that in a second. A silo. But let me get to that point in a second. So basically the father found out about this and disowned her. He said, you may not have any of my property, inheritance, nothing's going to be yours, you can't touch anything. And he disowned his daughter, so upset about this. And he made a neder, he made a vow that she cannot have any benefit out of any of my property. So this nice, rich girl was now out in the street with nothing. You know, except for a husband who she loved and supported. That's what she had. So initially, the sources seem to say that he went away to study in the beginning for a short period of time. He came back, and at this point she was already disowned by her father, had no money. And this is when they had to sleep in a silo. They didn't have anywhere to sleep, they didn't have any blankets, so they covered themselves in hay and slept in a silo. That was
How did
that
she
was
support him?
They support him.
How did she support him?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
Sweat?
Yes, jewelry. That one thing she did, she sold jewelry. That's the fifth. But that's one thing. I don't know how far that went, because she was wearing rags at the end of this whole story, which we'll get there. But at first, they're living in his hay silo. And at a certain point, he was inspired. It's unclear exactly when he switched to go off to study again in the yeshiva, because he was inspired to do again. We do have here, there's a famous story. That probably many people are aware of, the Rabbi Akiva, what was his model which he used to inspire himself? He once saw a stone that was carved out by water. He said, who carved out the stone? So they told him it was the water. The water was dripping on the stone. And after a long, long time, the water was able to carve out a hole in this stone. So Rabbi Akiva said, if soft water can carve out a hard stone, certainly the Torah can penetrate my heart. That's what Rabbi Akiva said. He used that as his example, as his model, to know he can go and study Torah and be changed and affected by the Torah. So the story continues that Rabbi Akiva then went away to the yeshiva again to study. He came back after 12 years. And he came back this time with a little entourage. He'd already become great. He had some students. And he came back with this entourage of people with him. And as he was coming back, he had overheard his wife's conversation. His wife was there. She was poor, she was wearing rags, she had nothing, because her father disowned her, her husband was away, and she really had very little for herself. People were telling her, like, you know, how long are you going to live like this? You're a living widow. I mean, your husband's not here, you have no money, what are you supposed to do? So she said, if only he'd go for another 12 years, I'd still be happy, right? So Rabbi Akiva, he heard this. Some sources say he didn't go in the house. He turned right back around, and he went back to study for 12 more years. Some say he did go in the house, didn't go in the house, but he went to... But bottom line, he was away for about 24 years studying. If that's your question. Yeah, at this point. He comes back a second time. He comes back the second time, 24 years later. He is now one of the greatest sages of the generation. He has 24,000 students with him. Seemingly the same 24,000 students that we were discussing earlier. And he comes back to his hometown to see his wife. And as he walks up, and as he comes into town, everyone hears this great gadol hador. The sage is coming to town. Everyone's crowding around to see him. And this poor beggar lady comes to see him as well. And they say, get out of here. Who are you? Get away from the rabbi. And he stops them and says, leave her alone. And he says the famous phrase, Shali v'shalachem shalahi. What's mine and what's yours belongs to her. I'm only so great because of my wife. Because she supported me, sent me away, inspired me. That's why I'm so great. Anything that I have to offer you is only because my wife enabled that to happen. That's what he tells them. And they back off. You know, get away from her. And she comes and they meet each other again. So that's the famous story. At this point, even seems to be before this point, her father became, Ruchim Baim, welcome. Her father had regretted his decision to disown her. I mean, this is his precious daughter, you know, she was poor, her husband was away anyways, and he was kind of upset that he disowned her. But the problem is he made a vow. And if you make a vow is binding. It's going to halacha. He had made a vow that she can't benefit from his property. And he's bound by this vow. So he hears, a great sage is coming to town. Yeah. Let me go and see if he can permit me to get out of my vow. So she says he's to go to the great sage. Not realizing this is his son-in-law.
He didn't realize.
He didn't know this. So the Gemara says he went and met with Rabbi Akiva, who was his son-in-law, but he didn't know. And obviously Rabbi Akiva knew who he was, you know, but he didn't know who his son-in-law was. He tells him the story, and he said that if you had known that your son-in-law would have studied Torah at all, even one word, would you have made the vow? He says, absolutely not. He says, I'm him, you know? And at that point, he actually gave him half of his possessions. The father-in-law became, you know, he was able to release his vow, and he gave half of his estate over to Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Akiva's wife.
Did the rabbi keep children?
They did have children, yeah. They did have children. Because there's even a source that could be had an earlier marriage before he married her and had children with the first wife as well. He had children with the second wife, but there's a source that says he even had a first wife and had a child with his first wife. So this whole process, the rabbis tell us, started at age 40. So Rabbi Akiva was 40 until he started studying Torah. And at that point, he had known nothing, really knew nothing. Again, we have the story of him seeing the water hitting the rock. Understanding it's a slow process, but a slow, steady drip can change a person. And that metaphor of the water hitting the rock, I find to be a very powerful metaphor. Because we know that, you know, one burst of energy to try to study is not going to change a person's life. But it's the slow, constant study, the slow drip of Torah penetrating a person, which changes a person. That's how we view it. It's like, you know, my Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Lipiansky, he says that he always gives a metaphor. He says that it's like a person wearing braces. You know, if you want to move your teeth into be straight, so if you take a hammer and knock them, you're going to knock the teeth out. Braces is a slow, steady pressure, and that's able to not put your teeth into the right position. So the same thing with study. Torah study, the mitzvah Torah study is supposed to be, it's not how much, but it's the consistency of it. Because if you're consistently studying Torah, so the Torah affects you. A one-time shot, you might take in the information, but it doesn't change the person. So Rabbi Akiva, the metaphor of the water dripping on the rock shows that, you know, a slow, steady drip of Torah, that's what changes a person. That's what's going to dig in, penetrate our hearts. That's what does it. If you just dump a bucket of water on a rock, the rock's not moving. You know, but if you have a drip going on the rock day in and day out, you end up with a hole in the rock. And that's that metaphor. So Rabbi Akiva went away, and he started from square one. He knew nothing. And we have sources to say that he had to sit down and study just the alphabet. He knew the Hebrew alphabet even. He couldn't read. He was illiterate. And he went with his son. And so this source says he went with his son to study the alphabet, which seems to be a son from an earlier marriage, what it seems to be. And that's what these sources imply. And he and his son together sat down, and they learned the Hebrew alphabet letter by letter, the aleph bays. That's what they did. And it's a picture of the humility of this person who sits there. His son, I assume, was much younger than him. He's 40 years old. He spent his life illiterate, and he says, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to start square one. People his age studying in yeshivas were already studying at high levels. He was already 40, and he had to go from Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, Hey. But because he was such a humble person, he said he was a modest and humble person, he was able to step in and start building blocks one by one to learn how to be a Torah scholar, to learn Torah, to study the Torah. And also understand, we mentioned before how in the beginning, before he went off for his 24-year period, he and his wife lived inside this silo. They lived in a silo. That's where they had nowhere else to live. And we have to understand the dedication of his wife. His wife, to Rabbi Akiva. And his wife could have, she had a wealthy family. She could have been living in her father's mansion, could marry any man she wanted to. Wouldn't have been a problem. But she says that I see this person as a good person. I'm going to dedicate my life to this man. And even though I have to give up everything I've had in my life, she was a wealthy woman, but she gave it all up just to be dedicated for her husband and for her husband's growth. And she should be an inspiration to all of us, what dedication can do in terms of personal growth. Having a dedicated partner, someone who's there behind you, it's an incredible thing. So to appreciate her dedication to Rabbi Akiva is an amazing model for us to show the power of dedication, the power of what it takes. Sometimes we have to sacrifice to grow spiritually, but those sacrifices go a long way. So eventually, we said he returned. He was away for 24 years. He returned from his studies with 24,000 students. And we discussed the story of his students passing away. We mentioned at the beginning of the class, his 24,000 students, again, seemingly the same ones, they all died during this time of year because they didn't respect one another. The Gemara relates that the world was desolate of Torah at that point. And we can't picture the tragedy of it, but 24,000 people to die is already a very heavy sum. But beyond that, these are the 24,000 greatest Torah scholars, in a way, in the entire Jewish people. This was the link from Mount Sinai to us, which was basically being destroyed. Because if you have a majority of Torah scholars in the world just pass away within a few weeks of the period, so you can imagine what that meant for the Torah. Those people who were supposed to carry on the tradition weren't there anymore. They weren't able to teach. They weren't able to pass it on to their students. There were some other scholars in the world beyond Rabbi Akiva and his students, but 24,000, I assume he had the largest academy in the country. This is in the land of Israel. And this was the link from Mount Sinai to our generation was going to pass on through this academy, through Rabbi Akiva, through these students, and they were gone. They're all gone. It was a Holocaust in its own way. That's what it was. And even in the Holocaust we're familiar with, we know the 6 million people who died, and also picture all the great Torah scholars, all the great leaders, the great Rosh Yeshiva, they're all part of it, And just like a Jew standing in 1945 looking at what's going to be with our traditions. We're gone, our people are gone, our traditions are gone, because there was such a small group of Jews left in the world. The observant Jews, there are very few left in the world. And thank God look today and things have flourished once again. But if you can picture that it was a small Holocaust at that point. It was 24,000 Torah scholars gone. That's what it was like. So Rabbi Akiva could have fallen into depression at that point. You can imagine his life's work. He started at age 40. He works now for I don't know how many years later this was. At least 24 years later, probably even longer after that this happened. He's probably, I would assume, in his mid 70s, so along those lines, my assumption, maybe a little older, I'm not sure exactly where he was in age at that time. I give up, I sacrificed the better years of my life to dedicate to Torah study. I was away from my family, I worked, and look, all my life's work is ruined, it's gone, God took it away from me. And you could see him, going into depression, going into retirement, relaxing. God forbid it happened to us, but how would we feel? Rabbi Akiva says, no, I have to move on. I have Torah to teach. I have to pass on traditions to the next generation. And he searched to find some more students. And this time, he was going to make sure to find students that were appropriate students, because the rabbis tell us his students died because they respect one another. So Rabbi Akiva now goes searching for students. He's to find students which he feels are going to be appropriate students, students which will treat each other properly and be able to carry on the traditions. And it says he found 5 students in the south. He found, the 5 names are Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Elazar. Those are his 5 students. And he went from 24,000 students to 5 students. And again, with his humility, he sat down and taught 5 students. You can imagine a small classroom with 5, after being the head of an academy of 24,000 students, going down to 5 is quite a dramatic change. But again, we see his humility throughout. With his humility, you know, he would say, whoever it is, whoever can study, whoever I can teach, I'm going to teach. So he found his 5 students to carry on the traditions. Yes?
Rabbi, what was the nature of the plague that God set on him? I mean, is it recounted in any way as to what actually occurred?
The Gemara uses the term Askara. Askara is usually understood as some, I think it's some form of choking, is what I think it is.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think it's a form of choking. Askara is supposed to be a very painful death.
It wasn't a plague?
It wasn't a plague like a disease, yeah. Askara is more like, I mean, I don't know if it means they choked on their food or if they had some sort of, you know, breathing disorder. I'm not sure exactly how it worked.
But Rabbi Akiva himself was spared.
He was spared, right. So again, your question is a valid question. Does he get any of the blame for this or not? I think there are sources which kind of go both ways on that. But he definitely was spared from it. He definitely moved on and
he had to be spared.
He rebuilt.
He had to continue to teach and rebuild. He had to continue to teach.
Yeah, but the thing is that there's a hint here that there was something that was lacking in giving mussar or noticing some defect.
Right.
So there
are sources that say that he actually tried to intervene. He tried to intervene with the students, tried to set them up with each other in ways which they would respect one another, not be jealous, but it failed. There are sources like that.
Because he tried that he was spared?
It could be. You know, because he recognized that he understood it was the wrong thing. He tried to intervene and it didn't work. Could be a spared for that. The source for that is the commentary called the Ben Yehoyada, who was written by the same author as they call the Ben Ish Chai, we usually refer to him as. He was a great Sephardi. Sephardi authority lived in Baghdad, I think in the 1800s or so, in Iraq. But so he actually writes this, that Rabbi Akiva actually tried to intervene. He tried to make sure they had proper groupings so they would not be jealous of one another, but it failed. And they still would not respect one another, and that's when the plague came. But you see Rabbi Akiva's resilience, his determination to teach Torah, his humility. Yes?
Why should you consider them to be so important when they exhibited the worst behavior that warranted for Hashem to kill them? Why are they at the same level of tzaddikim? What do they have that we should think about if they couldn't live with each other like nice, decent people and use the Torah and all the things that Rabbi Akiva was teaching them to live nice, enjoyable, life, why worry about them? They've rejected what we consider to be the righteous way of living.
Good question. I'll give you a few different answers to that. Number one, we have to remember them because we have to make sure we don't fall prey to that. We have to make sure that we know studying Torah doesn't just mean the information, it means becoming a good person. And if we look at them, they're the example of people who were Torah scholars in terms of the knowledge, but they didn't have the character which goes along with it. And before Shavuos, when we're approaching receiving the Torah on Shavuos, we have to take that as a model for ourselves, that it's not just about the knowledge, it's about the character which is involved in it. That's one point. Number two, commenters point out that if you look at the wording of the Gemara itself, the Gemara calls them 12,000 pairs of students. So commentaries point out that if you were watching them as an onlooker, you would see them being friendly to another. They're pairs, they're groups, you know, they got along. Any onlooker would not see and this lack of respect. But because they were such great people, God judged them very strictly. And that's why they got judged so severely. Because on their level, they showed this respect. On our level, it could be that they looked fine. They weren't fighting and knocking each other in the face and calling each other, you know, dirty words. They weren't doing that. But there was some very subtle disrespect, which we expect much more out of a Torah scholar. You know, because they were Torah scholars, we expect more out of them. They have higher expectations. And because they lived up to expectations, that's why God took them. That's what some commentaries point out as well. So either way, it's an example for us to understand that along with Torah knowledge has to be growth in character, being a good, caring, respectful person. But also, on their level, it could be that because they were so great, that's why they were judged so harshly.
Well, this all ties together in a way, you know, because Rabbi Akiva was selected, what his wife saw in him was
based on his character. Yeah, very good.
And his students were killed because they had something bad in their character. And also counting Sephira, when you count it, it's trying to build up
your character. Yeah, it also all ties in. Very good. All ties in. Very good connection.
But you're showing disrespect, is what you're saying.
Yeah, so these students were showing disrespect on some level to one another.
Normally in a chabura, you see an argument going back and forth.
Right.
And one's trying to better the other with their knowledge.
But that's not always disrespect. That could be because they're searching for truth.
Ritual.
Right,
I mean,
it's ritual. Right.
Hillel and Shammai.
Yeah, Hillel and Shammai argued vehemently, but they respected one another.
Yeah.
And it was because they respected one another, they argued because, you know, your opinion is valuable to me. I have to make sure that I'm right. Maybe I'm wrong. I'm looking for searching for truth. Yeah.
Of any specific time that this change in their behavior took place? Because obviously, if he first started with them, and he's there for a few years, and they behave that way, he's gone, they're gone, the whole thing's over.
Right.
So at some point, in the way they were living and learning together, some profound change took place, which he couldn't do anything about, apparently.
Yeah.
And they didn't want to do anything about it.
Right.
So what... Do you have any idea?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if we have any record of that, but it's a good question. So he moves on, and with his resilience, determination, moves on to his five new students. And these five students really become the pillars, the basis of the Mishnah, the Talmud, by extension, of the oral tradition. Because the oral tradition from Moses at Mount Sinai to the very days passed through our sages. Passed through from teacher to students. And Rabbi Kiva was a major link in this line, to the extent that we have a rule that the Gemara cites, that every single Mishnah in the entire Talmud is based on Rabbi Akiva's teachings. Everything. So our corpus of oral law we have this very day is all founded from Rabbi Akiva. I mean, it's a passed from tradition from Mount Sinai, but it's coming through Rabbi Akiva. He's that link in the chain to our rule, to the oral law we have this very day. And his students are the major names in the Mishnah. Rabbi Meir, there's a rule that any Mishnah that has no name put to it is Rabbi Meir's. So it's Rabbi Meir's opinion. So any Mishnah written and recorded anonymously is Rabbi Meir. And that's a lot of Mishnahs. One of his students, Rabbi Shim Bar Yochai, who will be celebrating his Yortzeit on Lag BaOmer, he is the basis of all Kabbalah, of all mystical Torah thought. He is the basis. He wrote the Zohar. And Rabbi Shim Bar Yochai is the basis of all mystical Torah thought. That's all. Rabbi Kiva was the one who generated it all. These are his students. He's the one who passed on the traditions to all of his students. So his students were all the major names and the basis, the foundations of the traditions that we have to this very day. Of the text of the Mishnah and the Gemara that we have, we link it all back to Rabbi Kiva. It all gets linked to him.
You said Rabbi Elazar was in there also?
Rabbi Elazar, Rabbi Yehuda, and Rabbi Yossi. Those were the five of this group. And all of them had major contributions in the Mishnah and the Talmud. So Rabbi Akiva is somebody who, he also, we have to look a little bit at how he looked at life. I mean, he's very inspired. The fact that he picked up at age 40 and became so great is a very inspiring thing. His humility is extremely inspiring. His wife's dedication is extremely inspiring. It's all very inspiring to us. But also, let's look at some of his teachings. So what Rabbi Akiva seems to have... I mean, he has a lot of teachings. In the Talmud, you can find him quoted all over the place. But I think there's a common thread you find in a lot of his teachings, which is very important for us to understand. And this common thread begins with his teacher. He had a teacher who was called Nachum Ish Gamzu. Nachum Ish Gamzu. He was called Nachum Ish Gamzu because he's the one who coined the phrase Gamzu Batova. This is also for the good. Famous phrase. Because he's the one who looked at life's tragedies, looked at life's difficulties, and always said, this is also for the good. Everything God does is for the good. So we called him the man, his name was Ish Gamzu, a man of Gamzu. Because he would always say, Gamzu, Gamzu, this is also for the good. He'd always say this. So he was a teacher of Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva carried on this philosophy. He always was able to see the positive in what happened in front of him. So we have a few different stories of Rabbi Akiva. There's one famous story quoted in the Gemara, Maseches Brachos. Rabbi Akiva himself says, a person should always be accustomed to saying the phrase, Kol de'avid rachmana latav avid. Everything God does is for the good. And there's a story. What's the story? Rabbi Akiva was once traveling, and he got to the city, and he wanted to find a hotel to stay in. And no one had any rooms. There was not a single hotel room available in the city. And they threw him out. He had nowhere to sleep. He says, I can't get a hotel room, so I'll have to go sleep out in the forest. So he goes out to the forest to go to sleep, and he had with him a rooster. That was his alarm clock, Rashi tells us. You know, the travel alarm clock was carrying a rooster with you. He wanted to get up for davening. He had his rooster, you know. He had a donkey. I guess he was traveling on his donkey, and he had a lamp. So the wind came, blew out his lamp, and a cat came and ate his rooster, and then a lion came and ate his donkey. So poor Rabbi Akiva's, he's thrown out into the woods, his donkey's gone, his rooster's gone, he has no more lamp anymore. So he says, you know, he said everything God does is for the good, not sure why, but he went to sleep. So that very night, an enemy troop came into that city and took everyone in the city as captive. So Rabbi Akiva said, now we understand, everything God does is for the good. If I had my rooster, they would have found me. If I had my lamp, they would have found me. My donkey, they would have found me, because they would make noise. And if I was sleeping in the city, they would have gotten me too. So this is all God's doing, and everything God does is for the good. That's the story. So we don't always see it as clear as Rabbi Akiva did. But that's a model for us. That we don't know exactly why bad things happen to us, but we have to know that, you know, everything God does is for the good, and at some point we'll figure out why it happened. So Rabbi Akiva's answer was immediate. Ours is not always immediate. But that, Rabbi says, a person always needs to say this. Everything God does is for the good. So we see Rabbi Akiva always tries to find the positive in the events which happened before him. Rabbi Akiva is also the one who famously said, V'yahavta l'racha kamocha zeh klal gadol b'torah. The great rule of the entire Torah is love your neighbor as yourself. That's Rabbi Akiva's quote. So love your neighbor as yourself is the great rule of the Torah. Klal gadol, this is a major rule of the Torah. Love your neighbor as yourself, what does that mean? It's seeing the positive in people. I can't love you unless I find something positive within you that I love and respect. So loving your neighbor as yourself always means I'm looking at the person and trying to see the positive in that person so I can exhibit love to them. So Rabbi Akiva said that one of the greatest rules of the Torah is to love your neighbor as yourself, to always see the positive in people. There's another story. At the very end, actually this story is quoted a few times in the Talmud. The story is that Rabbi Akiva was walking with the other rabbis in Jerusalem after the destruction. He was walking with, let's tell you who he was with. He was with a bunch of other rabbis before the destruction, after the destruction of the temple. And they're walking by the Temple Mount, and they see a fox coming out of the Holy of Holies. I guess the ruins of the Holy of Holies. So everybody started breaking down in tears. So this is the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the holiest room in the entire world. Now there's wild animals are trampling through it. So Rabbi Akiva starts laughing. So everyone else is crying, and Rabbi Akiva's laughing. So they said to him, why are you laughing? He said to him, why are you crying? You know? So they said, well, we're crying because the Torah says that nobody can come near this room. Only the Kohen Gadol goes into this room. It's such a holy room. And now foxes are trampling through this room. So of course we're going to cry. So Rabbi Akiva said, he saw the positive in it. He said, you know, we have prophecies of destruction. We have prophecies of redemption. If I see the prophecies of destruction have come through, then certainly the prophecies of redemption are going to come through as well. So when he saw the destruction, the wild animals overtaking the Temple Mount, he saw, now I see there's going to be a redemption. When I see that these prophecies of destruction are coming out into the world, coming into fruition, I know I'm going to be redeemed by God as well. And then those same prophecies, they're both going to be true. That's what Rabbi Akiva said. So he started laughing. He saw the fox. He's laughing. He was picturing already the future redemption. That's what he was picturing. So he saw the positive in the events. And everyone else broke down in tears. They couldn't handle it. It was such a tragedy. And Rabbi Akiva saw the positive. A few more points just to complete the Rabbi Akiva's life story. Rabbi Akiva's greatness was so great, he is compared on par at times with even Moses. There is a fascinating passage in the Gemara which Moses is actually shown Rabbi Akiva in a vision. Now Moses was shown all of history, the rabbis tell us. You know, and it says that Moshe, at one time, he was, you know, it says he went up to heaven. And he found God, and God was fixing crowns on top of all the letters of the Torah. If you look in the Torah, someone does get crowns on them. Yeah. Rabbi Akiva was famous for drawing out lessons from the crowns of the Torah. Rabbi Akiva looked at every letter, every verse, and every single crown as a message from God. He actually found lessons in the crowns of the letters. That's what the rabbis tell us. So Moshe goes up to heaven, and he sees God putting the crowns on the letters of the Torah. So he says to God, what's holding you back? Why do you have to still be tying crowns to the top of the letters of the Torah? And God said there's going to be a great man in the future, and he's going to take every single one of these crowns and teach lessons from these crowns. So Moshe said, let me see him. Let me show me this man. So now God transports Moshe to the future, shows him a vision, and he sees that there is a great teacher, you know, teaching a class. Even Moshe couldn't understand the class. And he was getting a little nervous. Moshe said, I don't understand his class. It's such a complex, advanced class. I don't get it. So finally, at the end, Rashi explains that he was teaching a law that Moshe had not yet been taught by God. So this is the future. So that's what Rashi explains to us. But Moshe then was, we found that out, he was settled. They saw a great man teaching the Torah. So at that point, Moshe said, why didn't you give the Torah through him? He's greater than me. Why are you giving the Torah through me? He should be your messenger to give the Torah. He's such a great person. So God said, he told Moshe, just silence. That's what I feel is best. He didn't give any reason. But Moshe had a good, his claim was a good claim, that Rabbi Kiva would be a great person to give the Torah through. That's how great he was. He could pass on the Torah to Jewish people. So it turns out, as we said, Rabbi Kiva is really the link to the oral tradition. He does pass on the Torah to us through the Mishnah as the link to the oral tradition, and Moshe is the link to the written law. But he said, Moshe himself said to God, Rabbi Kiva is greater than me. You should pass the Torah on through him. So that's the story that is discussed. That shows you Rabbi Kiva's greatness. Another story about Rabbi Kiva, the Gemara tells us in Maseches Chagiga that four great rabbis entered into what's called the Pardes. Pardes literally means an orchard, but there it refers to the depths of the Torah. Pardes is used as an acronym for Pshat, Remez, Drash, Sod, which are the four levels of understanding the Torah. The simple meaning, the hints in the Torah, the drushas, expounding upon the Torah, and the secret parts of the Torah. That's what it stands for, Pshat, Remez, Drash, and Sod. And it says four rabbis entered into this, meaning they entered into the deepest, you know, the deepest, most mystical, you know, parts of the Torah. And it says, what happened to these four rabbis? There's four rabbis, Ben Azai, Ben Zoma, Rabbi Akiva, and somebody named Elisha Ben Avuya, who later was known as Acher, the other, because of what happened to him there. Ben Azai died from it. He couldn't handle it. There was just too much spirituality, and I would say it ripped his soul out of him. Ben Zoma became crazy from it. It was just beyond comprehension. It made him crazy. Acher, this Elisha Ben Avuya, he became a heretic from it. And he was known throughout the Talmud later on as Acher, the other one, because we didn't want to call him my name anymore because he became a heretic. And Rabbi Akiva is the one person who entered into these depths of understanding and came out in peace. He came out in shalom, it says. He came out in peace. That was Rabbi Akiva. So the only person of these great rabbis who was able to handle the depths of the entire Torah was Rabbi Akiva. No one else can handle it. Each one in their own way could not handle it, Rabbi Akiva could handle it.
Were some of these great rabbis his students, his five students?
They weren't his students. They were, I guess, they were contemporaries of his. They weren't his students. Yeah. And just to finish off with the Rabbi Akiva's death, the famous story of his death. Rabbi Akiva, as we know, was killed by the Romans. The famous story. He was a great martyr of the Jewish people. And the story begins with the famous metaphor that Rabbi Akiva gave. Rabbi Akiva once was speaking to it was during the time of Roman rule over the land of Israel, and Rabbi Akiva is the one who teaches us that one has to give your life for Torah as well. When you say in the Shema, you say B'chol Nafshecha, to love God with your entire soul. So Rabbi Akiva taught us that means you have to give your soul for God. You have to love God even by giving up your soul, by dying for God. So the story goes that the Romans had decreed against Torah study, and Rabbi Akiva was still convening his classes as usual. So another great person named Papus ben Yehuda came to Rabbi Akiva. And Rabbi Akiva was teaching Torah, and he said to him, "Aren't you afraid of the Roman governors, of the Roman police? Why are you still teaching Torah?" So Rabbi Akiva told him the famous analogy. He said, "It's kind of like a fox that's walking along the river, and there's fish in the river, and there's fishermen's nets, and the fish are trying to dodge all the fishermen's nets. And the fox says, 'Why don't you come up, come with me up into the dry land? It's safe up here. There's no nets up here. Just come join me on the dry land.' So the fish said, 'Are you crazy? You know, here we have a chance. On dry land, we're going to die. That's for sure.' So Rabbi Akiva says that that's the Jew in Torah study. If I don't study Torah, I'm for sure going to die. If I study Torah, so at least I have a chance. You know, it's like a fish out of water. A Jew not studying Torah is a fish out of water. A Jew with Torah is fish in water. A Jew without Torah is a fish out of water." That was the metaphor, that's the analogy that Rabbi Akiva gave to studying Torah. That's why he said, I'm going to continue teaching Torah, to studying Torah, even in the face of the Roman government, which decreed against it. So eventually he was caught, and he's thrown into prison. And in his prison cell with him is this other man who just questioned him before. Papus ben Yehuda is also in prison. So they said, what are you in for? You know, that's the classic prison conversation. So Papus says to Rabbi Akiva, he tells him, Ashrecha Rabbi Akiva, praiseworthy are you, Rabbi Akiva, because you were caught and thrown into prison because of your Torah study. Oy lo lepapis, woe is to me, to Papus, because I was captured for trivial matters. Seems to be Papus was involved, I don't know, there's some sort of like black market dealings or something, that's why he was in prison. But he was there because he taught Torah. So the same two met up again in prison, and we see the difference. So that's Rabbi Akiva's when he was captured by the Romans. So they took him out to be executed, and it says it was the time for saying Shema. And they took metal combs, and they were flaying off Rabbi Akiva's flesh with metal combs. And as they were doing this, Rabbi Akiva was saying the Shema. He was accepting upon himself the Olmachu Shemayim, the yoke of the heavenly kingdom. And his students were there watching, and they said, Rabbi Akiva, even now, you're still saying Shema. Even at this point, even through the pain, through the suffering, you're still able to say Shema and accept the yoke of heaven upon you. So Rabbi Akiva says to them that my entire life, I always read the verse, you have to love God with your entire soul. And I always wondered, when will it be that I can fulfill this verse? And finally I have the chance. And the Gemara tells us that his soul left him as he said the word Echad of Shema, the God is one. As he said that word, Hashem Echad, his soul left him. And a heavenly voice came out and said that Rabbi Akiva has a place set aside for him in the world to come. And that was the death of Rabbi Akiva. And a heavenly voice came out and said, praiseworthy are you, Rabbi Akiva, that your soul was taken from you with the word Echad. With proclaiming God's unity, that's when your soul's taken from you. So commentaries say a very interesting thing. They say that when the Gemara says Yatza Nishmaso Be'echad, his soul left him with the word Echad, they infer from that he didn't die from the Roman people executing him. He didn't die from those combs combing his flesh. He died because his soul at that point was so enwrapped with God, his soul just left his body. He was saying the word Echad, God is one. He was so much clinging to spirituality, so much clinging to God. That's what took his soul out of his body. It wasn't the Romans, it was his personal connection to God. That's what a few of the commentaries point out. So Rabbi Akiva, at the end, it wasn't because of the Roman executors that he died. It was because of his clinging to God. His soul was able to leave his body. And praiseworthy Rabbi Akiva, your soul left you by saying the word Echad of Shema, and his place in Olam Haba set aside for him. So that was Rabbi Akiva's end. So Rabbi Akiva should serve for us, you know, as inspiration in so many ways. The tragedy of his students dying, you know, is a tragedy. Always needs more understanding, as everyone has questions about that. But Akiva's life serves as a great model for us, that it's never too late, that's number one, never too late to become great, to study more, to build our knowledge, determination, resilience, never giving up. Shows the importance of Torah study, how even in the face of the Romans, Rabbi Akiva didn't flinch for 1 second. Even as he was being killed, he didn't flinch for 1 second. His devotion to God was there to the very last moment. Again, it says his wife is extremely inspiring, his wife's dedication to him, his wife setting aside her wealth and her life and her family to be devoted to her husband, devoted to her husband's Torah study, her husband's greatness. The importance of developing our character. Rabbi Akiva was picked by his wife because of his character, not because he was his Torah knowledge, he didn't know anything at the time. Importance of character. As Phil pointed out, you have that connection. You know, we're building our character at this point in the year in order to approach Shavuos. Our goal during the Talmud of the Omer is to be working on our character traits, working on our midos. And as we approach Shavuos, we're supposed to be becoming a great in character so that we can take in the Torah knowledge with that prerequisite of having people with derech eretz, with good midos, with character. So before Shavuos, this is our path to greatness. Rabbi Akiva is a model of a path to greatness. Rabbi Akiva stands really as one of the greatest sages of all time, really the conduit of the oral tradition from Mount Sinai, and somebody who we can still draw from to this very day. Any other questions?